Oh,
recording
yes,
has started.
we're going to be enticed to make a trip despite this nasty weather we're having. We're going to be talking to Liana Salama, right?
It's
Salama.
Salama.
Salama. I knew I'd get it
Salama.
wrong.
Okay.
And she's going to tell us all about the 2024 Winter Fancy Food Show in Las Vegas. It's
That's
not
right.
snowing there, is it?
It's snowing here in Chicago. I don't think it's snowing in Vegas, though. I'm not out on site just yet.
Right. Yeah, the weather's hideous, I know.
Yeah.
Now, just for people who don't know, is there some short way of explaining what the sponsor is, the Specialty Food Association?
Yeah, you bet. The Specialty Food Association is a nonprofit, member-driven organization founded in 1952, and we represent primarily the makers and manufacturers of specialty food products. We have about 3,800 makers and manufacturers as member companies right now.
Wow, absolutely amazing. And what a
Yeah.
job this organization does. I mean, I forget how we've been going to these shows for I don't know how many years now. When did this start?
So this will actually be our 48th Winter Fancy Food Show. We have two a year, one in the winter and one in the summer. So we've been doing it for over 50 years. This is our 48th winter
Now,
event.
I
Okay,
mean, so this is like, go ahead, Rabbit.
and the summer one is in New York City, and the winter
It
one,
sure is.
it moved, right?
It did. So this will be our third year in Las Vegas. Prior to that, it was in San Francisco. I think it took a year or two where it might have popped into San Diego for a one-off, but we were mostly in San Francisco until these last 3 years.
Yeah, it used to be three times a year too, and they eliminated the Midwest.
Yes,
Didn't
that is
they?
correct.
Yes, right. I mean, this is, I don't even know how where to start explaining what this thing is like. I mean, it goes on for 3 days, and you just keep eating and walking. I mean, it's
There is definitely no need for breakfast, lunch, or maybe even dinner. There's a lot to fill up on the show floor. We've got about 1,200 exhibitors who will be showing different types of specialty foods throughout the show floor over the 3 days. Everything from cheeses and meats to different snack products, plant-based foods, beverages, both alcoholic and non, just about anything you can think of, just with a specialty bend to it, which we kind of think of as being those products that are kind of elevated in quality. Maybe they use a higher quality ingredient. Maybe they're more global in nature, or they have kind of their own story of origin to tell.
Now, if people want to get involved, though, they have to apply, and you get to monitor what it is they have to offer and whether it seems worthwhile.
Yes, exactly. So makers and manufacturers of specialty foods do apply for membership. We have a vetting
Okay.
process that we go through. And then if accepted, they are welcome to exhibit at our shows as well as enter our SOFI Awards, which is our annual Excellence in Specialty Food Product Award program.
Yeah, I'm dying to see what they are every year. I mean, I love that.
Yeah. There's
Yeah.
something like 45 categories at this point, so there's a lot to see for sure.
Yeah, now you do have these special categories. But, one of the things that has always fascinated me about this, the fancy food shows and the SFA, is that you devote a lot or point a lot of attention to new and startup companies.
We sure
What are
do.
some of the opportunities for them? I mean, you actually at one point had a price reduction for people to enter to make it more accessible to smaller companies, right?
We do. We have an entire area of the show floor that we call New Now Next, and that is a combination of two areas, one that used to be known as Incubator Village, which is where we actually partner with a number of different incubator kitchens around the country, and they will bring cohorts of the folks who are working on their products, you know, kind of polishing them up, getting them ready for market, and they will bring them to the show as part of a cohort at a lower cost of entry. This year, we have three participating in the Winter Food Show. It's Oregon State, Louisiana State, and Rutgers Food Innovation. And then as well, right next to the incubator village there is a whole area of startup, which is a smaller tabletop exhibit for those folks who are really just breaking into the market for the first time. So we've dedicated an entire section of the show floor to being able to showcase vendors, makers, manufacturers who are really polishing their products, getting them ready for prime time. It's really exciting. You see a lot of creativity in there.
Now, this is also a world. This is a worldwide thing. This is not just limited to producers in the United States. There are people who come in dozens and hundreds from across the world.
Oh yeah,
absolutely.
Order to have an entry to the U.S. market, I guess it's for them.
Yeah, absolutely. So of the 1,200 exhibitors we're expecting, we have about a 40-60 split of international versus domestic. So there's a lot of international presence on the show floor. In fact, we have partnered, every show we work with a partner country who comes in, and they're kind of the overall, I would say, kind of sponsor of the show. And for this winter show, we're really excited. It's our first Asian partner country, and it is Japan. So they're going to be coming in. Yeah. So they're going to be doing a number of different things. They'll be showcasing different makers and manufacturers from Japan. But then they're also going to be doing a number of cooking demos for us, as well as some educational sessions on some of the hot trends and topics that are coming out of that that part of the world. So we're very excited to have them on board. We also have pavilions from Italy, France, Morocco, Canada, China, all kinds of folks coming in from all over the world. So it's really a holistic look at kind of, it's almost a global food pantry. You're seeing things from all corners of the world at our show.
Yeah, I made a note on my papers, my paperwork for this particular interview. I've never known of the category, a profession or a career called a snackologist.
Yes. Yes. So we have a woman joining us. Her name is Jeanette Donorama, and she actually is a snackologist and former culinary producer for the Rachel Ray Show. She's going to be leading some sessions in building snacks and creating really fun and interesting ways to serve snacks as you're entertaining. There's going to be a Super Bowl stadium built out of snacks that your guests can graze. There is, yeah. And we're also going to be, if you've heard of the charcuterie chalet showdown, it's a TikTok trend that's out there where people build what are, they kind of look like gingerbread houses, but they're made out of charcuterie ingredients, so meats, cheeses, nuts,
et cetera. Yeah, I'm not sure I understand that. I mean, I've read about that, and I'm not sure I understand it.
Yeah, if you pop onto Google, you can see some of the pictures. And what people will do is they'll take the ingredients and they'll use toothpicks to fix them in place so that you can kind of pull them off using the toothpick to snack on them. But people create some really elaborate houses out of it. It's really, really interesting to watch. So we'll be having a live charcuterie chalet showdown during the show this year.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, am I remembering correctly that at least one year you had an Obama statue made out of a food product of some kind? Do you remember that?
Oh, goodness.
That might have been
before my time.
That, you know, might have been Jelly Belly, and it was a portrait.
Maybe
it was a portrait of Obama made out of Jelly Bellies, I think. Jelly beans. I mean, there's so much surprise involved, and all this camaraderie. Some of the same people you run into every year, and then sometimes you make new friends and new acquaintances, and it's just absolutely a miraculous thing how it all comes together. I mean, what was my question? My question is, what are you particularly excited about in terms of producers this year?
Hi, I'm back. I don't know what happened.
What happened?
I think you did drop for just a second. I'm not sure why. Hopefully we have you continued on.
Yes.
I didn't stop the recording on this end, so I think you'll be fine.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, the Obama piece might have been before my time. I've been with SFA for a little under a year. So, but gosh.
We've been going for years, absolutely for years.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't remember when it started, but the first time was just so spectacular, I couldn't even believe it. And I began watching trends, and I've seen them develop over the years. So I have a long view of this health and wellness trend, for example, vegetarian stuff. And, you know, it you can trace it. It's a very good a telescope into the future of specialty food, isn't it?
Things like Greek yogurt.
Mm-hmm.
Seems to be, I recall, Fahea, or however you pronounce it, appearing in the show for the first time, just like three to 5 years ago.
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of, I think specialty foods as a category or an industry is really uniquely positioned to bring some of those things to market because they tend to originate from what people eat at home or what they grew up eating or something that's in their background. And they bring it in and they're able to kind of, you know, introduce it to the market in small, authentic batches. And then as it takes off, you see more and more people start to pick up on the concept, like a Greek yogurt now, where everybody makes it. You see it everywhere you go. But it would make sense that it would start as a specialty food from maybe somebody who, you know, who remembered it from growing up.
And there are a whole lot of prizes called Sophie's. Sophie sounds like she ought to be a singer or something like that.
It stands for, tell us what it stands for.
I believe it is Specialty Outstanding Food Innovation, SOFI.
That's it. I mean, I never could remember what it all is.
Yeah.
But that keeps, that list of things keeps growing every year as well.
It does. We're up to more than 45 categories for the SOFI Awards. So just about any, you know, from sauces and different condiments to proteins to different cheeses, there's a category for just about any food you can think of. And they're very, very well, they're popular. Folks love to enter them. They love to get the trophy. They love to talk about the SOFI Awards. It's been a real cornerstone of SFA for quite a while now.
Yeah, no, I remember one year we were there, and there were potato chips or potato crisps, as my Brits call them. They were so good. We said to each other, "They're going to win Best in Show," which they did.
But the
intriguing thing was next year they were back, and the product was vodka.
Yeah. potatoes.
Because their potato chips were actually made out of pieces of potato that didn't fit into the normal mode of what you would package it as.
Well, that's really interesting because one of the things we see a lot of right now is this notion of upcycled ingredients, which is kind of what that is, right? It's using ingredients that are essentially byproducts of food products. And using them to create new products. So we're seeing a lot of that all over the floor lately, which is really exciting. You know, there's a whole sustainability, environmental consciousness to this industry that is really, really near and dear to its heart, which is just wonderful to see.
You know, there's you have a pitch contest too. Tell us about that.
We sure do. It is called the Fancy Face Off. And what will happen is on Monday, right at the close of the show, four finalists, who we're in the process of choosing now, will pitch their products to a group of, I think it's four or five judges, I'd have to check, but they will identify. So they get up, they talk about their product, they talk about the background of it, they talk about the ingredients, the packaging, and then the panel of judges will ask a few questions, and it's a competition, and the winner walks away with a nice check that they can use to further their business. Almost like a Shark Tank, live and in person.
But there are also the specialty seminars that I think it's very important about, like upscaling and that kind of thing. That, I mean, for people new to the special, even some people who are not that new to the specialty mm-hmm. food market, need to know what others have gathered by way of experience. And you do a lot of that.
We do. We have a number of different educational opportunities on the floor. Everything from, you know, I mentioned there's some cooking demos, but there's also, you know, panel sessions on things like consumer trends, which for retailers and for manufacturers, it's important for them to understand what types of things consumers are drawn to so that they can create products, position products, and, you know, ultimately stock their shelves with products that are really going to be in line with what consumers want. And then we have other information about, you know, to your point, different ways of sourcing ingredients and looking at some of the sustainable opportunities that are out there. So there's a ton of educational opportunity for both the retailers who come to buy products for their stores and for the makers and manufacturers who are there to show their products off.
Right. There seems to be a lot of collaboration going on now. Have you noticed that?
I have. You know, we've actually been fortunate to be the source of some of that. We've had makers and manufacturers who have found one another at our show. We had a company that made pupusas, and then one, the table next to them made a vegan cheese, and they found one another, and they actually embarked on a product collaboration together. It was fantastic. So there's a lot of those types of opportunities that crop up at our show.
Just to give you an idea, listeners, this really is the place you have to go. We were wandering the show, well, not exactly wandering the show, one year, and we ran across a wonderful British product called Walker's Shortbread.
Walker's, yeah.
Who should be at the stand of Walker's ice cream but Mr. Walker?
Oh, my goodness. It's so funny. So you knew him back when?
Oh, yeah. He's English.
We knew his product back then.
Yeah. You see a lot of that. You know, there are a lot of brands that have come up through the Specialty Food Association and the fancy food shows. You know, we often hear about Pop Chips, about Ben & Jerry's. Walker's comes up in conversation a lot. So, you know, it's really rewarding. Again, as a nonprofit organization, you know, it's really rewarding for us to see some of these brands and these makers start out small and then really grow into something that's well-known and really, really special.
You know, we've been in on the ground floor of a number, like I'm thinking of some cheese makers, and we follow them, and we do these the interviews, and we air them around the time of the fancy food shows, and we can trace how they grow and expand.
Mm-hmm.
What's that like hint? You know, the water.
Yeah.
We were on the ground floor of that, and now they're mega companies.
Yeah, they're everywhere.
It's
really exciting to see.
Well, I mean, you know, you have to have a lot of stamina. That's the one thing that's problematic is you really have to you have to be able to handle it. You go from Trey Cochon to Ariana, her products. And then you go to Jelly Belly, and you get jelly beans, and then you. So,
it is.
But,
it's a whirlwind of different flavors and experiences around every corner. You know, you go from one thing to something very different in an instant.
Yeah, no, I remember the one product. I can't remember the name of the product, but I remember that they had in their exhibit, they shot something out of an automatic, like, cannon thing. I can't remember the product now, but it went haywire. That was pretty funny. And
that's wonderful.
Yeah. And what were some of the... Oh, and then there was the year they had that the funny product where you consume it, and then everything afterwards tastes sweet for hours.
Yes. I think those the miracle berries, right?
Yeah, that's it. Miracle berries.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember seeing a demo where you could you ate one of those, and then
yeah.
you could drink like you could suck on a lemon at like
exactly,
and it tasted like candy. It was crazy.
Yeah, well, the problem with that was that people were there to taste these different food products, and once they got
right.
a taste of that, everything tasted sweet.
Right, it'll mess up the rest of their day.
Oh yeah. Now, the other thing I wanted to ask you about is not that many people focus in on it, but, I mean, it's kind of overwhelming seeing these volumes of food everywhere, you know? But then people report on it, but it doesn't get as much attention. What's left over there does not go to waste. You donate it. Explain that program.
Yes?
Hello? Did we lose Leanna? I think we lost Leanna. Oh, there she is.
We're back again.
Leanna, I was just asking you to... Yeah, I was just asking you to explain what you do at the end of the show where you donate all that food that's kind of overwhelming in volume to various charities. Yeah, tell us about it.
Yeah. So we actually, let me pull up here. So, you know, I mean, as a nonprofit organization, you know, a lot of what we do is about giving back. So at the close of the show, all of our exhibitors package up their food, and we donate it to Three Square, which is Southern Nevada's only food bank and the area's largest hunger relief organization. So thousands and thousands of pounds of food get donated at the end of every Winter Fancy Food Show, and it's just such a nice way for the organization and for all of our exhibitors to be able to give back.
Right. Is there some way you can, I mean, it's going to be touch and go whether people are going to make it to this current Winter Fancy Food Show. What are the dates of that? And also, could you project ahead to the Summer Fancy Food Show in New York and give our listeners tips on that?
Absolutely. So the Winter Fancy Food Show is coming up quick here. It's actually next week, January 21st through the 23rd at the Las Vegas Convention Center. And then the Summer Fancy Food Show will take place in New York City at the Javits Center on June 23rd through 25th. So that's going to be another great show. You know, New York is always such a great place for people to explore, you know, in and outside of the convention center. Spain will be our partner country for the summer show. So we're very excited about that. Yeah. So it should be, we should have two really, really great shows to look forward to this year.
Right. Well, I'm all in your corner here for this because I think it's one of the greatest things that goes on. and happy to talk to you about it.
I'm always happy to talk about it.
Is there some place they can go on, listeners can go online to get more information?
Absolutely. So our website is specialtyfood.com. So you can go there, find out information about the organization, about the Winter Fancy Food Show, and the Summer Fancy Food Show.
Right.
And we wish you speedy recovery to your friend who had an accident in
yes.
the snow.
Your husband.
Thank you. I appreciate him. Yes, my husband. Yes. I wish him speedy recovery, too. I need him around here.
Well, thank you for taking the time to talk to us as well.
Absolutely. Thank you,
Leanna. And have fun. Having fun. It is a fun event. Thank you.
Yes, sure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Listeners, we're going to be talking to Rowena Scherer, who tackled a big topic, a taste of the world, celebrating global flavors. And if we could get the numbers out of the way just to start with, Rowena, we have around the world, a family cookbook around the world in 60 dishes, which is something. I'm going to, of course, ask you how you determined these dishes. First of all,
yeah.
I'd like to ask you, I have another question, is who is the intended audience for this book, this cookbook?
The intended audience are families, basically families and children. So it's
okay.
Not just a children cookbook, because it's actually family meals. It's dishes that the family can cook together. Every step actually has sort of like a chef hat that can tell you the level of difficulties. And my whole mission is to get family and make it a family activity where you can come together and make a meal and talk about the country and learn about the country.
Well, that's good, because that's what you do. that was your intention.
Good. Check the box.
How about that? You do whatever you said. You've actually done what you set off to do.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, I mean, can I mention that the book format itself is charming. The illustrations, I'm looking at the cover here, and you have all these little illustrations of, like, here's the Taj Mahal, here's the Statue of Liberty, here's a Japanese gate, and the pyramids, and a chili pepper.
Yep.
And it really reflects, I think, an outstanding quality of this book, is how clear you make everything. You have to be a teacher.
Actually, you know, this book is an offset of my business. So
mention that. I meant to say that.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
Sure. So, yeah, my company is called Eat to Explore. I am actually a trained chef, but never really entered the world of food too much later in life. But I, as an individual, have traveled and lived around the world in my previous life. I'm from Malaysia originally, and I grew up cooking with my mom. That's how I kind of developed the love for food. When I came to the States, I kind of honed in that skill by taking a culinary degree at the French Culinary Institute. But everywhere I go, my passion has always been, what is the culture? What is the food? Where's the market? What's the restaurant? What do they eat? You know, like, that drives me. And then when I had children, I realized that it's even more important with our children these days, because I think growing up, it was sort of like there's no, you know, competition for my attention, right? Yes, there was phone, but now you got the social media, you have everything. And parents are just losing a battle against all this other media options, right? And so I'm almost trying to bring back time that parents should try to grasp while their kids are younger to make a meal together where you have to have your hands dirty and you can take a time off from technology, but yet connect in a more meaningful way. And as they grow up, the children can be a global citizen and they can be more aware about what's happening in the world. And then what makes it more interesting than true food, right? So
yeah.
Food has, you know, been generations been the go-to that brings people together. And in any country you go to, that's always, any celebration, it's always around food. So why not make it the topic?
Yeah, but you did some kind of a numbers job, didn't you? I mean, weren't you?
I did. I worked on Wall Street for many years. And, you know, that pays the bills, but it's not feeding my soul. So this feeds my soul.
I wish I kept track of how many people that I know who've left that world and started in food. You know, who's that wonderful, the woman with the bakeries in Boston? She was on Wall Street for years.
Yeah, I know many people who left the Wall Street and created a second career. But, you know, it's great. Like, you know, with Wall Street, it allows me to travel the world, and I got to live in many different places. Otherwise, I wouldn't have a life here in New York. So I'm thankful for that, but it's also nice to be able to do what you truly love and what I truly love.
Right.
So.
Well, Well, you remind me very much of teachers I've had. you're so organized. I mean, you're just so organized. I mean, you know, you have how to use this book. It starts out, and you go point by point by point. There's nothing that you're leaving out. I mean, it's so clear.
Thank you. And I also find, especially with children, visual is very important. And so most cookbooks out there are just lots of text. Okay? They have one major photo. But, the step-by-step is very important, and it gets them excited. And, in fact, I have more projects going on. I'm trying to, have it where my little bird, my little Mundo bird, can actually instruct the cooking, too. So I have constantly new ideas, but the cookbook is a good one.
Huh. Well, now, but you have not totally abandoned your business acumen.
No,
and your capitalist streak. Yeah, because you also, you can actually buy mixes off your website, can't you?
Yes, you can buy the mixes off the website. You know, I actually have to tell you a story why this cookbook comes about. So my primary business, which is where I spend 100% of my time, this is the extra that I don't have. We have 24 countries. So this cookbook is just 20 countries. So we now have 24 countries. Our latest actually was Ukraine that we actually donate a percentage help the children of Ukraine. But that is my business, right? And then what happened is over the years, all my customers are like, we really love your recipes. Can you just share the spices? I know we can buy them. And I'm like, I can, but after a while, it's just like full-time job just trying to share recipes. So I said, I'm going to create a cookbook so you can actually enjoy it on your own. And what we're providing in our boxes is it's more than just the recipes, right? We have a booklet that teach you the geography and the music and the art, the history. We have playlists by music. We have, music playlists. We have books that you can go get. And so it's a very much an experience more than just food. So this cookbook is just purely recipes of books, of the recipes. So it's food. So anyway, the cookbook came about because I just wanted to make my customer happy. And so now they can actually buy the book and make all the recipes themselves.
Great. I mean, the kids, our kids didn't seem to have any interest in cooking, but our grandchildren really do. And they want to understand what's behind.
So the new generations are really the younger kids are driving the, I feel my timing is perfect because I really think the newer generations love the idea of cooking their own food. And maybe some influence of Food Network and the little kids cooking competition. But I personally, growing up, loving the idea of cooking my own food. I know what I eat. And now with children, they want to learn, right? It's curiosity, not just of the food but of the culture. And there's so much conversation around, different culture. And I think kids are curious. They're generally born curious anyway. It's how, sometimes the exposure they get. But to answer your question, I think a little bit of media and social media where there's TikToks and they see all this food and they see how to do it well, really get them, pick their interests. And I think we need to hone in into that.
Right.
So.
The other thing that your approach to this cookbook, that again, I know from experience with my granddaughter, particularly my granddaughter, is they want to know the why behind the recipes, and you address that, and that's often overlooked in cookbooks intended for children, they're curious about why.
They are very curious, and I also don't believe in kids just eating pizza and pasta and more cookies and desserts. Like, they can make a real meal and they can eat like everyone else, if you just don't have to make it too spicy or too, that their palate can be expanded. And I've seen it, and I used to teach little kids as well. I used to teach it, you say, for example, all the third grader. But like, if you, they look at the vegetable, they're like, "What is this?" But when they are involved in making them, all of a sudden they're like, "Oh, I want to taste what I made." You know, like,
yeah.
Get them even grocery shopping. Like we in our boxes, we don't, like the E2 Explore cooking kits, we don't provide the shopping fresh ingredients. We want the parents to take the kids to the grocery store. It's a learning moment. You go to grocery store, you teach them, feel like a green avocado versus a ripe avocado, like give them a $20 and say, "Hey, let's budget. Like, how much can we buy with this $20? That's such a learning moment that people overlook.
And the other thing, my suggestion is that you should be alert to take away the things that they pull off the shelves and put in the shopping cart.
I know. You're like, "Look at the ingredients. This is so bad for you. Eat whole food," right? It's true.
Yeah.
You can actually have a conversation and say, "Hey, look at what's in this thing."
Exactly.
So I always find going to a grocery grocery shopping is overlooked. People just order online. But hey, take a break. Go to the grocery stores. It's actually a lot of fun.
And this is a nice little chapter here, your tips for successful cooking. I mean, these are pretty basic tips, but they need to be said. Like,
yes,
safety first.
Yes.
Wash your hands. Don't forget to use soap. You know, be ready to. Those are all great tips. And people skip over things like that because they're basic. But you can't assume that everybody knows. Now,
yep,
how did you
exactly
figure out what areas to include? You know, and how many?
Yeah.
Go ahead. Explore Asia, explore Europe. How did you sort through? I mean, the world is so big, and there's so many different food cultures.
I agree. So, first of all, I like to categorize around continent because I feel like, you know, it's a great way to learn geography too. So food is also geography, you know, can be part of geography.
Yeah.
And can
you're
be
talking
part of
to Peter. Peter is a geographer by training.
And so. History, right? If you think about historically, the spice trade has created different cuisine around the world.
Oh, sure.
Right? And how Africa have using India spice, and how even Peru have Chinese and Japanese influence. Like, you know, history plays such a big role in the food we eat, right? Look at America. It's a blend of a lot of different nations.
We just interviewed somebody who wrote a book about the food of Peru. And, I mean, that's a great example because they have an indigenous culture going back forever and ever and ever, and yet they've welcomed all these other cultures, Spanish, Asian, the Japanese. I mean,
Japanese.
We know a lot of these chefs. And so you can't look at the cuisine of a culture from just one perspective. You have to have all this other stuff.
Exactly. And how they're adapting to the environment, right? Like, we have a Peru box, and every dish has a potato, because that's where potato comes from, right? Even their lomo saltado, which is like a Chinese stir fry, has, like, you know, French fries in it, like a fried potato. So it's and then you get to learn about that, which is so fascinating.
I asked this author, the thing that I never understood about Peruvian cooking was why the national dish is, what's that, rodent? The guinea pig.
The
national dish of Peru is guinea pig.
Yes,
coya.
That's right. Yeah.
And this author told us that if you go into an authentic Peruvian kitchen, you're going to find in the corner a warm spot where there will be these rodents, and they eat all of your scraps, and you don't have to worry about cleaning up.
is funny. That's it. It's true.
Yeah,
you know?
Funny.
It's true. Yeah. So going back to your question on how why I categorize it by continent, I just feel like it's a great geography. And so it's nice to show Asia and Europe. And even though we put Middle East separately, it's a big part of Asia continent and Africa and Americas, obviously. And then the countries that we cover, a lot of it are places that I've lived or I've been to and kind of more popular, and also have a more longer life to create a cuisine, right? Like Ethiopia, for instance, is like a cuisine that is, you know, dated thousands of years, and so the same thing with Greece.
Yeah.
And so it's like, you know, all the more unique countries, and as we grow, I'm going to always look at, you know, if that's as we grow too, more and more, we work with a chef from somewhere local that I can collaborate with to make it as authentic as possible.
Now, where did you actually start out on this journey of life?
So my journey of life started in Malaysia. So obviously,
well,
I initially
Malaysia,
have Malaysia.
Malaysia is a pretty big place.
I know. If you have been, it's a small town called Muar. It's south of Malacca. Malacca is a big Nyonya cuisine place. It's on a coast so I'm originally from Muar, and then I got a scholarship to study in New Zealand. That was the first time I left the country. Been on a plane. I was 17. I went to New Zealand for college, graduated, and got a job in Singapore, first in finance. my mom always said, you know, best way to get your head start and make some money is in finance. So I got my accounting finance degree. So my first job was actually as an accountant with Deloitte within a year. Got a job with J.P. Morgan, and then they sent me to New York. And so I came to, that was my first trip, and I came to New York. Lucky me. And so I ended up in New York for a few years, met my husband, stayed here, been married 28 years. We then moved to Hong Kong, and I live in Hong Kong. Then from Hong Kong, I was in Australia. I lived in South Korea for a while with J.P. Morgan, and then in India, was in a team that did the office. So
where were you in Australia? Where were
so
you?
So I was in Sydney.
Yeah, we lived for a while.
I know. Australia is one of the places I need to add at some point because the food is so good.
You what?
Sydney. Sorry.
She needs to add something about Australian food.
Oh yeah.
I need to add Australia as a continent. It's a continent, you know.
Yeah,
it is a continent.
It certainly is.
Yep.
Yeah. We have a cousin who grows organic avocados in Tasmania.
You know, the first time I ever had avocado was in New Zealand. Never had it before.
Really?
And I first had it, I thought it tastes like durian. So I'm not sure if you guys know this king of fruit from Asia. It's called durian. It's spiky.
Yeah, I know durian.
Yeah, it smells, but the texture is so rich.
Yeah,
and the texture is so rich, and it kind of reminds me of it was the first impression I have of avocado.
We have a great niece who went out for, I don't know why she went out to New Zealand and fell in love with the place and has never left. So, yeah.
It's a beautiful country. But, you know, when I was there, which was in the 80s, I just can't wait to leave. I mean, I was too young. It was not, you know, it's the middle of nowhere. It
was
great for education.
The problem is it's too far away.
Exactly. It's just like, you know, like no other place to go. And there's more, you know.
Yeah, I love Australia, but, I mean, I felt really isolated. Of course, I was living there before we had all this technology, too. I mean, at our fingertips.
Were you? Where in Australia?
In Geelong, Victoria, near Melbourne.
I've been to Melbourne. Got a lot of close friends in Melbourne. I love Australia. I love to visit. I don't know if I would love to live there. just yet. I do love New York.
There's no comparison. Melbourne's a Victorian city. It's the opposite, clear opposite of New York, I think.
Well, let's put this straight. We do not believe, like Ava Gardner. Ava Gardner was a movie star probably before you can even remember.
I know Ava Gardner.
She starred in a movie by an Australian author called Neville Shute, which was, and the novel was set in the world after a nuclear explosion.
Oh, right.
Oh.
And somebody asked Ava Gardner about Melbourne, and she said she thought it was a great place to make a movie about the end of the world. Needless to say, she was not retained by the Australian Tourist Board.
It kind of can feel like that in certain places. But, pick out a recipe that you think really exemplifies very strongly its place of origin. I mean, they all do. But there are some outstanding ones that we associate with these places. What ones would you like to pick out?
I always said, Dorowat for Ethiopia. I mean, everybody, if you go to Ethiopia, that's really what you eat. And then the other one I would say is, bulgogi. We call it dakgogi because it's chicken for South Korea. Like, that's kind of a go-to barbecue. And then I guess, Japan teriyaki, I think everybody knows. So
yeah.
I don't know. I can't pick a place. Like every country,
every place
is always my favorite, right? That I would say my go-to, and then the others are just, to me, I don't want to say secondary, but not like the main dish, like that I can associate with the country. So every country has something.
Well, I had a follow-up question to that. Is your concept works as you've presented it, but I'm wondering how all these different regional cuisines are thriving in a global world as we have it now. I mean, there aren't many places that really shine on their national traditions, culinary traditions, as much as they used to. They have blends with other cultures.
Right.
You notice that as a trend that's happening.
Yeah, that's like all the modern Asian, modern this, that's a spin to it. But, I think as we evolve, but if you think about it, right, even the modern version has really a strong influence by the main dish.
Uh-huh.
So if we are able to still teach what the main dish is, it's a great way to then appreciate the spin to it. In a way, that's why Australia, to me, is a little bit harder to even create a country box for, is because they are really a spin of many countries. They are very modern.
I'm looking now at your chapter on the United Kingdom. Now, that's a challenge.
No, but yeah, it's a challenge.
Believe me,
I've spent a lot of time in
England.
It's all your national dishes, right?
Yeah.
And in fact, people will ask me,
here's what you have.
Your
typical is grilled chicken and tomato sauce with cucumber yogurt sauce and naan, tikka masala. I don't know many British people who would consider that a typical national dish.
Well, it's not your typical national dish, but I'll tell you a story, and it's actually explained in that chapter.
Okay.
It is a national dish because in India, it's chicken tikka. There is no chicken tikka masala. So the tikka masala came about from UK, where a chef actually put tomato sauce. So what we have was a mix of both, So it's when you add the tomato sauce. So tikka, it's Indian, but as you know, India is a was a big part of the British colonies.
Right, exactly.
So they brought the influence back. So and that's kind of where it comes from. And then we have people that's like saying, well, the Irish stew is Dublin, but I'm saying UK does include Northern Ireland. So and Northern Ireland has Irish stew. So it's yes, it's a mix and why I don't have fish and chips. I do have fish and chips before in other recipes, but I never really put in my box because it's fried fish and it's just really fresh
exactly.
fish and it's really nothing on the spices that you can incorporate. And what I wanted was to share the spices, which is why we have the tikka masala and not fish and chips.
I just read an article that blamed the English for ruining Chinese food. You think about what the chop suey houses in London.
Yep, that's true.
And probably the same is true of the Indian cuisine,
yep.
I would think.
Yep. No, like what you said, right, there has been a spin to it. Like even Chinese food, I personally, my, heart of heart, I would love to do a really authentic Chinese box. Like our Chinese was more, like my China recipes, it's more meant to be, it's almost Americanized, I hate to say this, right?
Yeah.
But it is meant to be crowd pleasers, something that kids will like, adults will like, right? They're not going to eat like such authentic dishes that it's going to be hard to accept. So what we have, like the chicken General Tso, we explain why it's General Tso, it's more American, but that is relating to a dish in Hunan. And then we have Mapo Tofu, which is normal, and then we have the gingerly soy, which is, again, it's more of a spin. So,
wait, have you seen Fuchsia's Battle Officer New Book? It's encyclopedic in size. Fuchsia's Dadlop on Chinese food. It's a really wonderful book.
What is it called?
I think it's just called China or Chinese Cuisine.
Oh, really?
Fuchsia Dunlop.
I'll check
she's
it out.
She's really good. Oh, yeah, she's
I'll
really
check it out.
It's kind of definitive. And she's lived there off and on for years and years and years. So.
Right.
And she does what
yeah.
she's
the
doing.
Best way is to collaborate with, once I hope to get to a point where I can actually travel around and collaborate with, someone local and share those recipes, that would be like my dream.
Oh, well, you're well on your way.
Thank
well,
you.
Well, I'm glad we finally got the direction straightened out, and because I think that it's a great accomplishment, a very difficult subject, and a great accomplishment for you to get this
Thank
cookbook
you so
out.
Much.
Listeners, again, it's Rowena Scherer, and it's A Taste of the World. And you also have your website. Why don't you give our listeners that as well?
Yeah, it's EAT number 2, explore, EXPLORE. So it's one word, EAT number 2, EXPLORE.com.
That's great. And that's a good resource, too, listeners. Well, Rowena, thank you so much, and continued success.
Thank you so much, and Phil.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, we're good?
Yes.
Hello? Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.